delighted that one of those major mess-ups wasn't my fault for a change. Oh, well. Huh.
Let's change the subject.
Yeah. Enough of that. We're in 1 Timothy, beginning chapter 3 this morning. I've got out the Bible I'm going to be using this morning. It's called the Hebrew Greek Key Study Bible. I don't know if any of you have that or not, but I hadn't looked at it in particular in the last few weeks, this particular study Bible. But I kind of chuckled. I was noticing, you know how study Bibles have a few notes at the bottom of the page, like you can see the text. Can y'all see that? Can anybody read it? Yeah. You can see down here, this is the study notes for this particular page. Well, the last week, Tony's subject matter, you remember kind of what it was last week. I want you to notice, here's where it starts, this whole page, that whole page, half of this one. Now, I kind of chuckled myself. I guess that's a reflection of the difficulty of trying to explain that or explain it satisfactorily. But at any rate, we go on chapter 3. This morning, our text is very appropriate because we are in the middle of an elder selection process to enlarge the elder board of our church and to get a few more elders on the elder board. And our text for today is the qualifications or the characteristics of what an elder looks like. And we've been going through this process for several months now. And we mentioned it last week, and I'll mention it again this week. We have announced the elder candidates. It's Bob Connell and Tony Floyd. We've had an opportunity for you to come together at a meeting to ask them questions. We've asked them questions, met a lot with them. And if you have any input that you would like to give toward that end, make sure that you get your input to us or your concerns or your comments to us within the next week or two as we move forward with that process. This morning, if you have an outline, I'm calling this Elder Anatomy 101, just a kind of a play on words for a school course or college course, talking about elders. Let's read our text. We'll be reading 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. I'll be reading from the King James Version this morning. Verse 1, this is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Three things that I want to talk about this morning. The first one is this, in regard to elders, the task he embraces. The task he embraces. You see in verse 1, it says, this is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. You see here that the verse talks about a man having a desire. Now, when I first look at this, and when you kind of first look at this at the first glance, I don't know if everyone is this way, but the first thing that comes to my mind is somebody desiring power, desiring authority, desiring to have a title put on them, a tag on their name, or letters at the end of their name, you know, like a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. Someone that is desiring something that in my mind is an ungodly, it's not that the thing that they're desiring is ungodly, it's just that the fact that they would want it, a position as such, just kind of rubs me the wrong way. I don't know if you're that way or not, but I always tend to look at the bad side of things, you know, so that's how I see that. But let's notice exactly what he's saying here. First of all, the phrase, office of a bishop, in the Greek language is one word. It's episkopos, from which we get our English word, Episcopalian, the name of a denomination we use for that word. If any man desires the office of a bishop, or desires this work, says he desires a good work. Now let's talk just for a minute about whether or not this man is desiring the position, or is he desiring the task. Now, I want to just use for an illustration a father. Let's say that there are two men, and you could easily find examples of this. We see it all the time. Here is a man who is a father. He has children. And this man has little to do with actually raising his children. Perhaps the home is broken and he just brushes them off to his wife and she, you know, has to raise them or whatever. Or perhaps he's just doing his own thing. You know, he may bring home the money and pay the bills, but as far as being a father, he's really not. And then on the other hand, you have another father who has children as well. Both of these men are fathers. But this second father actually is involved in raising his children. He teaches them. He shows them how to do things. He spends time with them. He interacts with them. He teaches them right from wrong. He nourishes them spiritually. Now ask yourself this question. Which of those men desires to be a father? The second. The first may biologically be a father, but that's about the extent of it, isn't it? But it's the second that we would say desires to be a father. Why would we choose him? Because of his actions. Because of what he's doing. He's actually being a father. Now, think of that insight there, just in looking at this verse. If any man desires the office of a bishop, if any man desires the task of being an elder, what do you think we might see in this man? That he's actually doing that. He may not have the name on his tag given to him, but he is actually involved and active in nourishing, first of all, his own family. He is involved in influencing Christian people's lives. That's how you know if a man desires this work, because he's actually doing it. He may not have a position. Matter of fact, he doesn't care if he has a position. That's what his life looks like. So this first verse says, if any man desires that. He desires a good work. You recognize, notice I say here, recognizing his heart and his vision. A real father and a real leader in a home and in a church has a vision of what he wants to see his family become. It's not just a reaction as the days and weeks go by. But there's a plan involved. There is something that this is the direction we're headed, and this is how we intend to get there. A manner of life, regardless of position. A person who desires this good work will be living his life in such a way, whether or not he is put in a position or not. That's just the way that he will live. And lastly, Notice a threefold calling. If a man desires this good work, there will be a threefold call. We don't see this in this text. But first of all, and at the very root of it all, God will be calling this man to this position. Secondly, there will be a call within himself that's evidenced by his desire. And thirdly, that is affirmed by a calling from the church. Now, at the root of it all, in the background of it all, is God working. But God works through the church. God works through our own heart and molding our own lives to prepare us for these good works. And so we see all of those things. So the first thing is this, in verse 1, the task he embraces. The second thing I want us to see is the traits he exhibits. The traits he exhibits. And there are several things here that are listed in the next three or four verses. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time just defining each one of them because they're pretty self-explanatory. There are a couple of them we're going to spend a little more time on than the rest. But I want to make a couple of comments about these traits to begin with. That these are character qualities. None of the things that are listed here have anything to do with ability. They have nothing to do with giftedness. And I've mentioned this before, and I'm not putting down other churches or whatever, but in my life, typically the way I've seen the church that I was in choose a pastor, the only thing that we looked at was how well he could speak, how well he could preach. And the decision to call him or not was based almost solely upon that. And like I said before, after you get burnt a time or two by someone who has great charisma but little character, you kind of modify your approach a little bit. But these qualifications have nothing to do with ability. They are all character qualifications. The second thing about this list is that they are all present issues. They are not things that he did when he was a little boy growing up. They are not things that he did 20 years ago. They are what is his life, what does it look like right now? So keep those two things in mind as we go through the list. The first one is blameless. It says he must be blameless. Now we could stop right there if we're going to look at these things as exclusive in defining them. Because there is no one who is blameless. There's no one who is totally and perfectly blameless. So what does he mean when he says he must be blameless? I think that he means that there is no unresolved blame. There is no unresolved guilt. There are no issues of wrong or offenses that this man has committed that have been left festering in his life. There is no one who could come forward and say, "This man cheated me out of something 10 years ago." It's not that he's without sin. It's that he is without unforgiven or unpardoned or unrestituted. Is that a word? Sins that have not been made right. Okay, so there's the first thing. Just a general statement that perhaps would include all of the rest of these. The second one, the husband of one wife. We're going to spend a little bit of time here. And the reason is because if you are from, as a lot of us perhaps are, from a more conservative type church background, this is a pretty much a qualifying test for a pastor or elder in a church. What does he mean by a husband of one wife? First of all, let's define some terms. Husband, that word means a man, a male, a grown male, a man. The word wife means woman, a woman. Okay, pretty simple, right? These words are used and they are rendered. Sometimes the word man is rendered man. Sometimes it's rendered husband. The context tells us how to render it, or how they rendered it when they translated the text. The word woman is sometimes given and rendered as woman. Sometimes it's rendered as wife. The context, again, tells you how it's to be rendered. If he's talking about just as simply as a woman, or is he talking about a wife? Well, look at the context. He says that he must be, and let's use just in general the word man and woman, a man of one woman. Now, how can a man have one woman unless he's a husband? I mean, it goes without saying that the guy is not shacking up with somebody, right? It goes without saying that we're talking about a relationship with which only a married people would fit. And so the context tells us we're talking about married folks. So let's say husband of one wife. But that's only the beginning of the issue. What does he mean, husband of one wife? Okay, I want to give you two extreme views. And I say extreme because not that they are absurd, but that they are on opposite ends of the spectrum. The first, if we take as conservative and as strict a view as you could possibly imagine, or at least that I possibly can imagine, then what he's saying here is that the husband of one wife is a man who has never had relations, sexual relations, with but one woman in his whole life, and that's his present wife. He's never been married but one time. He's not a remarried widower. His wife didn't die and he remarried. He's only been married one time to one woman. He's only had intimate relationships with that one woman and no one else. And that's him. Okay? On the other end, perhaps the most liberal explanation of this that I have heard, is that he's talking about polygamy. It doesn't matter how many times he's been married and divorced, as long as he's only married to one woman at one time. He can't have 15 wives. He can't have two wives. He can only have one wife at a time. And that's all that phrase is saying. Now, those are two what I'm calling extremes. And I'm not saying either view is absurd or foolish, even though it may be. But I'm just saying those are two extremes. Now, somewhere in the middle there are all kinds of other views. Some take the view that this man cannot be divorced, but his wife could have died and he remarried, so he's a remarried widower. That would be okay, but he cannot be divorced. All right? Others, in fact, a lot of the churches I've been in would even disqualify a man who married someone who had been divorced. Even if he married a woman and she had been divorced, he would be disqualified. And I mean, the text doesn't say anything about his wife's marital statuses or past history or whatever, but that would also be included in there. Now, here's the point that I want to make. It doesn't matter which one of these views you end up saying this passage means. You have to interpret it to come to your conclusion. I don't care which one it is. You know, we are, and I'm as bad as anybody else. We want to say, just take it as for what it says. You know, I believe the Bible means what it says. It doesn't matter which one of these views you hold to. You've got some explaining to do. If you think it means a person cannot be divorced, but he could be remarried, a widower, then you've got some
you've got to interpret this phrase because it doesn't say that. You see what I'm saying? If you think it means polygamy, you've got to interpret this phrase to explain that to us because that phrase doesn't say that. It doesn't matter what you hold to, you will find yourself interpreting the phrase to explain what you think it means. Everybody has to do that. Okay? Now, saying all that, I'm going to tell you what I think it means. All right? This is the right one, right? And I'll tell you, I found myself over the years hating to come to this conclusion. Because I find myself hating to move from what I have always viewed as a conservative explanation to a more liberal one. I hate moving in that direction. But honesty, I believe, forced me to do so. But the more I think about it, perhaps this is the most stringent explanation of all. And I believe that this phrase is saying that this man has eyes but for one woman. He's not a flirt. His eyes doesn't follow other women around. He is faithful, not just in his legal status, but he's faithful in his head to one woman, and that's his wife. Other women do not feel uncomfortable around him because of something they can't explain. Other men do not feel uncomfortable around him or their wife being around him. He has eyes for one woman. As Job said, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? A man can be divorced, and if that's all this phrase means, he can never have been divorced in his life, but he cannot be a one-woman man, or he may not be. And on the other hand, a man may have been divorced 40 years ago, not even been a Christian, become a Christian and have been faithful over the years to his wife, and yet to hold this in front of him when he obviously has a life of respect and fidelity, I don't think is what the passage is saying. I think it's talking about right now. What is his life like? Is there a pattern of trust for ever how many years it may take that this man can be said that he is a one-woman man? That's where I'm at on this. Okay, it, in my opinion, is a little harder to qualify than just being only married once or whatever. The next phrase, vigilant. Vigilant. A man who is serious. A man who is not slothful in his pursuit of God. A man who is busy. A man who is not complacent about his life. Sober. Now, this sober doesn't mean have anything to do with being drunk. It means serious. He is not always just a prankster or a cut-up, although that is not the opposite of being sober necessarily. But he takes life seriously. Of good behavior. Self-explanatory there. Given to hospitality. He reaches out. He involves himself in the life of others. Being apt to teach. Now, I like this. Being apt to teach. You know, I used to think that this, of any of them, that if this was going to, one of the characteristics was going to be abilities, it would be this one. And most of your translations may say able to teach. But the word able leaves something missing that the word apt has. Okay? Apt. A-P-T. Do you ever take an aptitude test when you're in school? Me and a bunch of boys took an aptitude test one time. I'm not going to tell you that story, but it was funny. Yeah, I'll tell it to you. You know how you take these tests every year in school? And me and my buddy, I mean, to us they meant nothing, you know. And I know this was wrong, but I'm not saying we did something right. But, it's a 2 or 3 day long test. Well, you take it one day, and at the end of the day, I got the counselor to talking, and he swiped a test booklet off her desk. Well, I went home that night and answered all the questions and made about 3 cheat sheets for 3 or 4 of us guys. And it's one of these speed tests. You're not meant to get through with it. You can't get through with it. You know, it's 150 questions, and if you work hard as you can and are super fast, you might get 2/3 of them done. Well, I work it all out, and make us a little cheat sheet, and about 3 or 4 of us guys, aced the thing. I mean, we got through with it before time, got them all right. Well, a few months later, she calls you in her office one at a time to discuss your aptitude. And I remember going in there, sitting down, and she said, "I don't know what went on, but somebody was cheating." I said, "I don't know how you did it, but this test result is worthless for you." And, "Yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am." And she said, "Even old so-and-so aced this test." But anyway, aptitude. Okay, it's supposed to show you your tendencies. Okay? If I say this phrase, if we're talking about someone and I say, "Old so-and-so is just apt to lie as to tell the truth." What am I saying? He'll have the tendency to fib just as much as he would to be honest, right? He's apt to do it. Now, that's what this phrase means. In fact, the word "apt to teach" is all one word. But being apt to teach means this guy will have the tendency to teach. He's just apt to do it. You hang around him long enough, you're liable to learn something. He's not going to sit you down in a classroom necessarily and have a teaching session. But by his life and just the things that he shares, you learn. That's just the way he is. And in that sense, that's not a gift necessarily. That's a matter of character. All right? Apt to teach. The next thing, not given to wine. And here, the word doesn't mean necessarily drunkenness, although it means close to that, of overindulging. Okay? This man will not have a reputation for liking drink. The next thing, no striker. He will not be known as a hothead. Does that mean he will never lose his temper? That he will never become angry? I don't think so. It just means that he doesn't have a reputation as being a hothead. Not greedy of filthy lucre. There's more on his mind than becoming wealthy. There's more that drives him, or I would not say not more that drives him. There is something else that drives him other than material things. That's not him. Patient. Not a brawler. Similar to no striker, I suppose. Not covetous. One who desires things that others have. And the last one that rules well his own house. Now look at that verse that's got that one in, because this is the only one that explains what he means here. He says in verse 5, "For if a man know not how to rule his own house, How shall he take care of the church of God? He says, this man must be one that rules well his own house, because if he can't rule his own house, how in the world is he going to take care and lead and guide the church? Now, what does he mean? One that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. Now, let me just pose a few hypothetical situations to you. Let's suppose that 5 years ago, or 6 years ago, however many it was, when I became an elder of the church, I had still have two boys. Let's suppose that at that time they were wild and unruly, that they were known as dope heads or drinkers or whatever. Okay, that they were irreverent, they were disrespectful. Would that have disqualified me from being an elder of the church? Okay, I think so. Why is that? Because he says, the text says, if a man can't guide his own house, how in the world is he going to take care of the church of God? And what happens is two things. Number one, I have more important things to do, if that's the situation, than guiding the church. Because my family and your family, anybody's family, takes a prerequisite over the church. And I ought to be, the way I ought to be spending my time, if that were the situation, would be in remedying and righting my own ship. And my time ought to be devoted to there rather than devoted to guiding the church. That's one thing. The second thing is this, that if that had been the situation, to some measure, I forfeit the right to be heard. Because it's hard for you to listen to what I would say about families if my own family is a wreck. Isn't that right? Now, we might say it ought not to be that way, but it is. Isn't it? It is. Okay. Then my question is where does that stop? Does it stop when my children become 18? Does it stop when my children become 21? I don't know. Daniel is 24. Daniel is 24. Suppose the next month or two he goes off the deep end and starts living in rebellion, not to me, but to God. Would that hinder my, and lives that way for 5 years or whatever? Would that hinder my service in this church as an elder? Yes, it would. You might would say, no, it wouldn't. I've known you and your family for years or whatever. It would. What if he's 35? What if he's 50? Where do you draw the line? I don't know. The text doesn't tell us. But here's my point, and the line is not in black and white. And I would say this, that the further my children are removed from being under my authority, if that were to happen when he's 60 years old and I'm 85, the effects of that would be a whole lot smaller than they are when I'm 45 and he's 25 or whatever. See what I'm saying? But where does it cease to be an issue with choosing an elder? I don't know. I don't know. But what I am saying is that it does make a difference. It does. One that rules well his own house. That's number two, the traits this man exhibits. Number three is the traps he avoids. The traps he avoids. Look in verse 6 and 7. Verse 6 says, "Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil." Now here, he gives us one more qualification. And the qualification is, he is not a novice. Now what is a novice? A novice is a newcomer. A novice is someone fresh and new. Someone who is not experienced. And what it's referring to primarily is a new Christian. This person is not just someone who's just been a Christian for a few months. Okay? And occasionally, in my past life, you know, as I have grown up in the church, and occasionally I've seen old boys, you know, good old boys that, you know, sowed their wild oats or whatever, and they became a Christian, and 2 weeks later they're preaching. And I'm not saying there's something wrong with that. I'm saying that it, most of the time, it can be unwise, because that fellow is not quite ready spiritually to handle such a thing. But notice what he says, "Not a novice, lest he fall into the condemnation of the devil." Now this can mean one or two things, and both of them would be true. It can mean that here is a snare that the devil has set for this man. And the snare that he has set is that this guy will become prideful. He will be proud and fall into the snare. He will lift himself up because of the position that he's been placed in prematurely and become proud. Years ago, we were at the church that we always went to, and one Sunday we had a guest speaker. And this guest speaker was not a novice. And he had such charisma and such abilities that he had our straight-laced church amening. I mean, there was an emotional aspect to the preaching and the reception of the preaching that normally was not in our church. And he, you know, it seemed like he just had the people involved in the preaching and responding to the preaching and everything. And, you know, I sat over here, my heart just heavy. Just aching inside. And, I mean, this hasn't, I don't know if this has ever happened before or since, but just feeling like this man is such a fraud. And thinking, how in the world can that be so with the success he's having today in this church? And I, you know, the thought came to me that this man approached our pastor and asked him if he could speak today. And man, I was so heavy and so burdened about this that after church I asked our pastor if I could give him a ride home, you know, just ride home with him, just carry him home so I could talk to him. He said, sure. And on the way home, I asked him, I said, "What did you think about, you know, the guy that spoke?" And I just told him, you know, before he even had a chance to answer, I said, I think there's something wrong somewhere. I don't have not one thing to base this on, but there's something wrong with that man. And he said, yeah, you know, he called me last night and asked if he could speak at church today, you know, and he said, but I know what you're saying. There's something not right. And, you know, the last I heard, just, you know, a week or so after that, you know, the guy was saying God had called him to Hawaii to be a missionary and was wanting to gain support. And, you know, my judgmental nature, I didn't think he was really called to Hawaii, you know. But the thing was this, This man had a past history of being exalted. And perhaps his heart was so filled with himself that he fell to the condemnation of the devil. Let me say the second thing that this phrase, condemnation of the devil, probably means. What was it that condemned the devil? His pride. The same thing that condemned the devil, he says, if you're not careful, and you place a man prematurely in this position, he will fall into the same sin that Satan fell into. Pride. In Isaiah, you read the seven things that Lucifer said. I will be exalted like the Most High. Six other things similar to that. I will be like the Most High. I will sit on the throne in the north. Tony used the verses in Genesis last week where Satan comes to Eve. And Satan tempted her to eat. What was the bait that he laid out for her? Okay? Here's what she responded. Tony read these last week. When Eve saw that the tree was good for food, was pleasant to the eyes, and was one to make her wise, she took it. Where did she learn those three things? Two of them from God. One of them from Satan. God placed every tree in the garden. And the Genesis account says that these trees were good for food and they were pleasant to the eyes. And then Satan comes along with a third one. You shall be as God. That is a prideful issue. She saw it was good for food. She already knew it was good for food. It was pleasant to her eyes. But now she learns, and the bait is one of pride. It will make me as God. That's what this one is, a trap. This man avoids these traps. He takes himself soberly. Doesn't exalt himself either in position or either in his own mind. But he thinks of himself soberly, not thinking of himself more highly than he ought to think, as Romans 12 tells us. That's the first trap, pride. It's a trap within. The second thing is prejudice. And that is the trap without. Notice what he says in verse 7. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. So here again, we're talking about the devil, something involved with the devil. Now I use the word prejudice very intentionally. What does prejudice mean? Is prejudice a good thing or a bad thing? Y'all know better than to answer, right? We think of it as bad, don't we? What does prejudice mean? It means to prejudge. To prejudge, to judge before something happens. Judge means to decide, to discriminate, to determine. So prejudice means to determine something about something before it's actually shown to be the case. Now, is that always wrong? No. Let me give you an exaggerated example just to make the point. Let's suppose that we're standing on the street of downtown Heber Springs and here comes a motorcycle gang. Something like the Hells Angels or something. And they're wild and woolly looking, and this guy is just one motorcycle. He's got a shotgun in his hand, and he starts to go down Main Street and he levels the shotgun and just, or say machine gun, and just sprays the street. People are hit. People are ducking.
5 minutes later, here comes another guy with a machine gun. And he sprays the street, and you know, you hear about this or whatever. And next day, you're walking down the street, and here comes a motorcycle with a guy with a gun in his hand. What are you going to do? Are you prejudiced? Yeah. Is that wrong? No. In that particular case, it makes sense, doesn't it? Okay, you have prejudged what this guy's about to do. Now, you may be wrong. And there are certainly times we ought not to prejudge. Now, here's the point right here. He says, moreover, this guy needs to have a good report of those who are outside the church. Do you know what those who are outside the church want to do generally? They want to prejudge you. They are prejudiced. They want to prejudge society, wants to prejudge the Christian leaders, to find something wrong. They are eager to find some fault in the church. And yet, in spite of that, he says, this man who would lead the church must have a good report in the context of those who are more than willing to find something wrong with him. He must have a good report. That's asking a little bit, isn't it? There's a verse in Proverbs that says this, a good name is rather to be chosen than what? Great riches. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. That's saying if you have the choice and you can choose between two things, great riches and a good name, you ought to choose a good name. How much more should we choose a good name when the other option is somewhat less than great riches? Let me give you a couple examples. 25 or so years ago, I had a couple of paper routes not long after Susan and I got married. And paper routes nowadays might be a good job, but back then, they were not. And this route work type thing appealed to me. You know, something that you're going to get paid the same amount of money, whether it takes you half a day or whether it takes you 2 hours. You know, you're kind of competing against yourself. You know, all that kind of stuff always appealed to me. So I grabbed these two paper routes. Well, in the course of having paper routes, you have paper boxes. And I learned pretty soon that it's a common occurrence for somebody to steal a paper out of a paper box. When I put 10 papers in, and I've only got quarters in there to pay for 8, you know, I can subtract pretty fast, and I figure out somebody stole 2 papers. And that's common. In fact, I had a guy tell me, while I had a paper route, and he was talking about a box that wasn't on my route, so I guess he thought I would be impressed with him, but there's a paper box at the top of the mountain up here, and he lived about a mile one direction from it, and his buddy lived about a mile the other direction from it, and every Sunday, one Sunday, he'd come up and buy a paper and leave the box lid down and kind of hook it where it'd stay down, and go off, and before he left his house, he'd call his buddy and say, hey, I'm going to get a paper. He'd get there first, buy his paper, leave the box down. His buddy would come up, the box already down, take his paper and put the lid up and go home. The next Sunday, the buddy would do it first, and he'd do it. So every Sunday, you know, one or the other of them was stealing the paper. Well, by having a paper route, I paid attention to paper boxes. You know, I'd see people open the box, and you can see they take 2 papers. Stealing, isn't it?
May not be but 50 cents, but it's still stealing. What if you go up to the paper box and it eats your quarters? Doesn't give you a paper. Okay? And you've got a bunch of quarters, so you finally stick some more in, and you've got a 50-cent paper, you've got four quarters in there, and it finally opens. How many papers can you get? Two. Is that stealing? No. It's not. It's not stealing. But what if there's a guy sitting over here in a car? He might be the paper man. And he sees two papers come out of that box, and you close the lid. Is he going to say, oh, well, it must have ate his quarters? No. What's he going to think? You stole a paper. A good name is rather to be chosen than a newspaper. Isn't it? If it's to be chosen more than great riches, how much more is to be chosen over a dadgum newspaper? Is it wrong to take the second one? No. It's not. It's not wrong. But what are you taking it for? The cause is mine, right? By that time, you're aggravated. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to read the first one and turn around and read the second one? I mean, you take it because, dadgum, you paid for it, right? But why? I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying sometimes, if you are going to have a good name, it's going to cost you. A newspaper is a small price to pay for a good name. Let me tell you one more illustration. Some of you think that I've got a reputation for being a picky eater. Okay? Okay, I like barbecues, but I don't like slaw. And I don't like slaw on my barbecue. All right? I went to the store once. I was kind of in a hurry, didn't have much time. And I went to the store and ordered a barbecue. And, I mean, every time I order barbecue, I very specifically say, no slaw. And watch them write it down. And so they got it, you know. I went back and fixed my barbecue, and it came back and it had slaw on it. Most of the time, used to, I'm probably getting worse at this. Used to, I would say, well, forget it, you know, and I'd go on and either give it to Susan or eat around it or just get something else somewhere else. This particular day, man, it aggravated me. And I went back, and I wasn't being nasty, I just went back in and said, hey, y'all, this is not supposed to have slaw on it, you put slaw on it. They took it back, and I could see them in the kitchen. Opened it up. Now, can you get slaw off a barbecue? You can't. I mean, if I'd have wanted slaw juice on my barbecue, I'd have said put some slaw juice on it, right? They come back, hand it to me, and I go on to the car, open it up, and golly, it just bugged me. I went back in, I said, hey, this has still got slaw on it. And the woman took it, you know, and I could tell she was frustrated at me. I wasn't being mean, but she was frustrated. You know, I left there with my barbecue the way I wanted it. But I'm not sure it was worth the price. Because I left there, I know, with them mumbling and grumbling about somebody so picky. You know, it's easy to get what is rightfully ours, but it's not always
worth the price. As we, not just elder candidates, but as you and I walk with God, I challenge you. Let's be what we ought to be. Let's pray. Lord God, I thank you. God, just for all that you have done in our lives. God, hopefully I have grown. God, I have grown together with these people. God, would you help us that we might be diligent, that we might be vigilant, that we might be sober, that we might be apt to teach, we might be apt to learn. Help us to hold fast. Be steady. Lord God, that we might bring honor to your glorious name. Amen.